Josh Nelson is here, though, to share some film joy with us.
Hi, Josh. How are you doing?
Film joy. Which film do you want to start with?
Let's start with All the Way Through Evening.
Okay.
This is a musical documentary. It's on a limited run. It's a limited run. Opens yesterday across Australia in certain cinemas, but in Melbourne it's playing at the Cinema Nova mm-hmm. in Carlton. Mm-hmm. Looks like it might only be a 1 week run.
Oh, okay.
So you've got to get in quick.
Yep.
It'll
come out on DVD.
Well, hopefully. It's an interesting one, though. The timing for this is quite poignant because tomorrow is World AIDS Day, and the film is really about a concert in New York that's commemorating composers, poets, artists who, well, died of the AIDS epidemic, really, during the 1980s. And this is by an Australian director, Rowan Spong, who's done a couple of other documentaries.
That name's familiar.
Yeah, his first documentary was really well-received. Again, small release films, low-budget filmmaking, but, you know, it really sort of impressive. Tears for Teacher was about transgendered teachers in the States. And the second one, The Songs They Sang, which premiered Bayside Film Festival a couple of years ago, was about songs that came out of the death camps, basically, in Eastern Europe.
Did they write songs in concentration camps?
Yeah, this was their way of sort of survival.
We'll find out a little bit more about All the Way Through Evening in a moment, and some other films, including Ken Loach's, I don't know if it's kind of a full Monty moment or not. We'll find out more with Josh very, very soon.
You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Filmology.com is Josh Nelson's blog. PH for the Filmology. Like acid. Josh is a self-described film critic. Okay, let's get back to All the Way Through Evening. So you mentioned AIDS documentary set in about the 1980s. I suppose very different time. You died then. If you got infected, you had terrible chance of survival.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's very easy to forget the AIDS epidemic. I mean, in terms of publicity for disease now and charity and so on, it's very much moved the shift away to Parkinson's, yeah. Cancer and so on, which is kind of interesting given a lot of the studies recently have been saying it's on the rise again. The numbers are on the rise. So this is it's a well-timed documentary, but it's also about capturing this in history where, you know, some of the characters and their surviving partners and relatives of these artists who did die from it, you know, this was like a war. And there's one of the things I think is that real triumph about this documentary and why it works is that there's a real intimacy with the interviewers. There's a real connection. I mean, I think this is one of this director's key strengths. He has getting these sort of stark admissions or this real, you get the sense that there's a warmth and comfortable sort of sensibility with the discussions. And yeah, one of the gentlemen says he stopped counting at 35 of the funerals he was attending.
Wow.
And he, you know, they liken it to a war. Mm. So that's part of it. What really works about this documentary is it works on a number of levels. So you have the historical backdrop, but it's centered around this concert, this sort of memorial concert where, you know, the work of these composers and performers is re-performed. So it's sort of a memorial in a sense. And at the center of that is this former activist, pianist, wonderful lady, Mimi Stern-Wolf, and she's an incredible character. She is the warm center at the middle of this film, who's truly trying to keep these songs alive. And there's these shots, these wonderful interviews inside her small New York apartment, and the place is littered with VHS tapes, like wall-to-wall kind of covered. And you get the sense that she's like this kind of gatekeeper for all these memories. And, you know, she's aging and she's conscious of that. And it's all about, I guess, passing on and trying to hold to the past and instill that into next generation. So it works on a very intimate, personal level with her as a character. But again, I think it's an annual or a biannual.
Event,
which is held. I think it's held around or on World AIDS Day.
Right.
Every year, and yeah. So that's I guess the centerpiece of these songs being performed. So we hear the songs being performed. I talked about Searching for Sugar Man and how it foregrounds the music is really key, and the music is allowed to sort of speak here. So we go through the performance. We get introduced to the works of these various artists, and one of the performers who sings the titular song All the Way Through Evening. It's an imagining of Walt Whitman walking through an AIDS ward in New York in the 1980s, and how he would, you know, concoct that or conjure that.
And is the song got a similar sort of cadence and rhythm to Walt Whitman poetry?
It does, and it just strikes you. The man has such a striking voice, and it is the centerpiece of the film, this final performance. And it sends chills. I mean, this is a really wonderful film.
Yeah.
We should actually say it is limited, but there's a special AIDS screening tomorrow, which I think is going to the charity, the proceeds.
Okay.
And then there's a Q&A on Sunday at Cinema Nova with the filmmaker.
It's 21 minutes to 6 o'clock, 774 ABC Melbourne. You're listening to me, Raphael Epstein. Josh Nelson is with me. Films thing, filmology.com with a PH. Let's talk about Ken Loach's latest. I have distinct memories of watching Kez when I was a schoolboy and being incredibly moved by it. He's still making films. Angels Share. Josh, what's it like?
This is a bit of a change of pace for Ken Loach. I think he has quite deservedly, a reputation for gritty social realist films that, you know, the working class of...
The kitchen sink drama.
Yeah, which he's so good at. You know, I mean, some of his more recent films that have touched on that sort of dour subject matter, his last one was Route, or Route Irish, depending on how you pronounce it, which was about... basically mercenaries or contract workers for Afghanistan who'd gone over there.
Route Irish is the road in Baghdad. It's the road.
That's
the airport to the hotels and stuff.
And we find out that one of them has seen something that he shouldn't have, and there's a sort of a government cover-up. And it's very much playing off the class, the war, and capitalism. And that was a really powerful film. And the one before, I think, was almost my favourite, which is The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which was the Irish uprising.
I think I saw that.
Yeah, Cillian Murphy stars in it.
That was extraordinary.
Just amazing. That's my favourite.
That was beautiful film.
So touching, gritty filmmaking is kind of his cornerstone, and you know, social class films. This is a really curious film because it begins in that context, set in Scotland. We have a character by the name of Robbie, played by relative newcomer Paul Brannigan, who barely escapes jail sentencing at the start of the film. He's been charged with assault. He's let off. He's given kind of community service. You know, that this is your last chance, thing. And within this community service, he starts a kind of a bond with the leader of this, who tries to introduce him to whiskey appreciation. You know, this sort of almost
whiskey
like this,
appreciation.
Yeah, almost like this father son bond. So much of this film is about fathers and sons because Robbie is about to become a father, but his soon to be father in law wants him out of the picture, and he's trying to bribe him to leave Scotland to head to England.
Right.
But out of this strange drama, this sort of dour beginning, the second half of the film suddenly switches pace. It's almost like Loach took Xanax halfway through the filming of this film, and then it becomes a heist film where Robbie and Robbie and a few of the other members of the community service bunch decide to try and steal a rare precious whiskey that's about to be sold. In order to kind of make a quick cash and set themselves up for life. And tonally, it goes from this very stark kind of dour, the community housing, so on.
Bleak grey skies, concrete buildings.
Comical kind of hijinks, journey up the mountainside, pretending they're whiskey appreciation. You know, these four, ragabouts pretending they're whiskey scholars, while The Proclaimers plays on the soundtrack, da-da-da-da-da-da.
So does it work?
Well, in a sense, but it's a curious mix of a film because there's one incredible scene early on which shows that Loach's his origins or the other type of filmmaking, where we get a scene where Robbie's confronted with one of his ex-victims, one of those outreach programs where the family of the other one, who tearfully recounts the assault and the effect that the assault has had on him, intercutting the sort of the interview or that moment with the actual assault. So suddenly your perspective on this character is quite a stark sort of turnabout because you see this dark, violent side and, you see the regret, you see the hurt caused by criminality. And yet, it's almost like Loach doesn't really want to pursue that beyond the mark of the film. So it seems to be doing two very different...
Doesn't he normally... I'm just curious to switch tones so much. I thought a lot of his films were made in collaboration with the actors and the script isn't really developed until they start workshopping the roles and the plot. So does it still have that sort of documentary feel, or does it feel a bit more like The Full Monty where it's a...
It's far more playful. Right, Second Half is really playful, like comical. I mean, Full Monty is probably, you know, a useful comparison because of that, you know, the group and the kind of the wacky gang and the hijinks. It's not unusual, though. I mean, I think, and these are ironically Ken Loach films I haven't seen, but Looking for Eric and A.I. von Kiss, which he did about sort of 7 or 8 years
How
ago.
How many films has he made?
Yeah, he's pretty prolific, you know, sort of a film a year, were more lighthearted. So he's sort of moving into that territory, but those films, I think, were more consistently lighthearted, whereas this is the two extremes. Look, I really enjoy it, and I think the Angels Share is the whiskey that evaporates during the distillation process. And they talk about, you know, this is what we're left with, and the rest is the Angels Share.
There is
still a class kind of reading that could be drawn from this. This is this idea of, you know, these are people who've had no chance in life, they've struggled and struggled, that maybe they deserve to skim off the top, and if they can sell off, you know, the whiskey, which is ridiculously overpriced, this one barrel of whiskey from the rich and wealthy, then maybe it's their fair share. So, you know, there is a kind of a thin class critique, even in the latter half, but I think you have to sort of push.
Are you thumbs up or thumbs down?
Look, I really enjoy it. It's a fun film, but it is a curious switching point, halfway through.
You might have a favourite Ken Loach film. I'm still stuck on Kez, but hey, that's just me. 1300-222-774. If you've got a query about movies, Josh will answer it for you. If you've got a favourite Ken Loach film, you can call or text us 0437-774-774.
On 774 ABC Melbourne, you're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Josh Nelson is with me. The film Critique Extraordinaire, filmology.com is the blog. And Josh, just before we move on, the Ken Loach film we mentioned, Angels Share, reasonably wide release?
Of the smaller cinemas, Como, Baldwin, Elstonwick, and the Nova in Carlton, that one.
Okay, cool. So, tell me about now. I know Frank Langella, is that how you say his name? He's been in a gazillion films, and this one has his name in the title.
Yeah, and this is a lead role, and he's really good. He was, from memory, he was Nixon in Frost Nixon.
And he really
nailed that role. He was really good. But yeah, you're right. He's one of those guys you recognize, but you can't sort of pinpoint where.
You have to IMDb.
Yeah, you do.
Look at the long list.
And then be ashamed when you realize he's been in everything. Look, this is quite a simple film. It's set in the not too distant future in upstate New York. And it's Frank Langella plays an aging ex cat burglar with early onset dementia. And his family, or his son and daughter, played by Liv Tyler and James Marsden, decide to...
Liv Tyler?
Yeah.
She's gorgeous.
She's stunning. And she was quite stunning, the Astor in the Lord of the Rings trilogy that I survived through on Sunday.
I'm going to ask you about that, okay.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
And they buy him a robot, which is like a medical robot to look after him, like a sort of servant in a sense. And, you know, at the start, he's this cranky old man. It's very much like the Clint Eastwood character in Gran Torino. Grumpy old man syndrome. Yep. But then he decides he can use the robot.
You're well on the way to grumpy old man syndrome.
I am already. Particularly with cinema audiences. He decides he can use the robot to steal from all his wealthy neighbors, which gets him into trouble.
Yep.
It's an interesting film in some regard. In some ways, I think it would have worked better as a short film because the central premise is kind of interesting. The relationship between Frank and the robot is nice, but it does a couple of sort of my pet peeves with film. It has the pseudo twist ending, which you can see coming a mile off, and you know it. You just don't buy it because, you know, the way they've set it up just doesn't make sense to the denouement at the end. So that's kind of frustrating. Susan Sarandon actually has a role in it as well, as a librarian. And, you know, there's this sort of none too subtle idea that no one reads books anymore. Frank's the only one who reads books. The old world is kind of gone. It's moving on. It's become technologically advanced. And he decides to steal for her this old copy of Don Quixote. This is, you know, one of the first editions. So it almost...
People fetishize Don Quixote a bit, don't they?
Well, it's a curious thing because they mention it, but... they don't really push it. I think they could have done more to sort of suggest that Frank and the robot are a kind of Quixote, Sancho Panza kind of caricature. But again, it's a thread that's left but that is not pursued. And that really characterizes much of this film. There's a suggestion that the man who's taken over, one of the yuppies who's bought out the library and wants to rent it out to Gen Xers, maybe a con artist himself. It's implied, but again, it doesn't really go anywhere. And this is one of those frustrating things that...
Just padding.
It is. It feels like they've tried to make a short film into a feature, but it doesn't quite work. So it's sort of in that halfway point. But there is a couple of nice things about this film. One is it's good to see a robot not evil. You know, so much of cinema is, you know, robots gone bad. Like hell. Okay. Everything's like hell, you know. And this is a quite a benign robot. This is a friendly robot, which is... But
Josh also, Nelson, advocate for good robots the world over.
Call me Asimov. The other thing is that... It's not fully fleshed out, but there's a sort of a nice comparison between Frank, who's losing his memory, and he becomes quite a pitiful figure, and the robot who has sort of perfect total recall and this sort of memory that could be used against Frank in the event of his arrest, where the police could take out the robot's memory, and this idea of should he delete the robot's memory. That's kind of nice, but again, it suggests that, but it's not fully fleshed out. So, look, it's worth a watch, but... It's kind of almost there. The performances are good.
I'm already thinking DVD.
Yeah, that's probably...
that's just me.
That's probably... Yeah, I'm not going to... Yes.
Okay. Robot and Frank, fairly wide release.
Palace Cinemas, Nova, River and The Sun in Yarraville.
Okay, now just briefly, the marathon, the Lord of the Rings marathon, did they brush up as well, the three films, as when you saw them the first time?
Well, I hate to say this, Asta. The first two films were stunning. They were film prints, but unfortunately, this is not their fault, the distributor couldn't get a film print for Return of the King, so we were forced to watch a rather awful digital copy.
Oh, and it was
a
rubbish image.
It's really... going from those rich, wonderful colours for that first 8 hours, which went surprisingly quickly, the last 4 hours were a bit of a stretch.
So it was 12 hours.
I sat in that seat for 14 hours. Yes, and I survived. But they didn't get a T-shirt that said, I survived the Lord of the Rings marathon.
Oh, well, good for you. Does it whet your appetite for The Hobbit?
Well, I'm worried about this 48 frames per second. The digital...
It looks fantastic.
Oh, I don't know. A bit garish for my liking.
Oh, no, no. The trailer's mind-blowing. I saw the trailer. I was completely sucked in. I was going to walk out the cinema after... it was the Bond flick I saw before. I thought, oh, who cares about James Bond? I want to buy my Hobbit tickets.
Well, I'll be seeing it in the States before you folks. So,
you're so special. You and bloody other unnamed people at this station all flying off to northern climes. How dare they? Lindy and I will be here holding the fort all the way through
till
Christmas.
I'm actually flying off as well.
Oh.
But I'm not flying off till after Christmas.
Oh, well, that's something.
So at least I'll be here until the 21st.
Lindy Burns is the voice you hear. Of course, she's on the radio after 7.
I am.
You're doing, you just got Lord of the Rings for the whole 3 hours.
Do you know, I was tempted.
The movie.
I dip out for you on Sunday.
I was really, really tempted. I'm going to lunch on Sunday with a girlfriend who was over at the premiere.
Oh, yes.
Working sort of in publicist
kind
of role. And I actually rang her the other night to see and tweeted and emailed and did everything to see, can she come on and talk about it? And she said, well, no, because I'm not allowed, you know, because she's actually working behind the scenes. Okay. And that's probably fair enough. But she'll tell me everything quietly on the sly on Sunday. And then, of course, I tell everybody on Monday. That's the kind of stuff that I do.
So if you want anything private and public, any secret,
I'm the man to
just tell Lindy and she'll just blurt it out across the state.
So I should tell you about Les Mis then, and then you can tell it. Because I don't get, legal intervention then.
Really? Oh, that'd be good. I was invited to go and see the opening of that. Maybe I should.
This is Lame is the film, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I don't know.
Sorry, this week can't talk about it, but I can admit that I've seen it.
That's any good? Oh, you can't even say.
I can't say.
You can't even say. I'm just so not interested in seeing it as a film. I don't get
yeah,
that.
Yeah, a bit. Even the thought of Russ singing live, you know.
Although, you know, I had a friend in London. He'd seen the stage show in the West End. He'd seen it like 25 times.
25 times?
He was just a little, this much.
It was the only show that I wanted to see when we were there a couple of years ago, and it's the only one we couldn't get into.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to get into. It was phenomenally popular.
Was it 25 years and counting?
Yeah.
Is it?
Crazy. Yeah. Anyway, that's still a sore
I saw
point.
It once in a jail. It was staged in a jail.
Oh, okay.
Half
okay.
Professional cast,
this
half
is part of
prisoners.
Your past.
This was in it was in London as well. Wandsworth Prison, which is where Oscar Wilde
sounds like a Ken Loach film.
It really does.
It was really weird, but very.
Were you
very
there for long?
Just the evening.
Okay, good.
Hard time.
I've been to a few prisons.
We'll talk about that later.
I've only been arrested a few times. I've never been convicted.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sure, that's what you tell us. Tonight. I'm on digital radio until 9 o'clock, and then we'll be talking about... I've interviewed him already. His name is Robbie Madison. You've been to see Skyfall. He was the guy who did the motorcycle stunt riding for Daniel Craig.
That was spectacular.
Near the beginning of the film.
Yeah, right. Oh, you mean it wasn't Daniel Craig?
I'm sorry. Oh, spoiler alert.
I'm shattered.
Spoiler alert. He's Australian. He's a... freestyle motocross champion. I have to get that right. He's called Maddo.
Yeah, Matt, eh?
And he and I had a bit of a chat.
So it was his first movie?
His first movie. Right. He nearly got to be in Batman, The Dark Knight Rises. But he got there and he... Oh, so there was something. Anyway, I can't remember what the story was. But he didn't get to do it. But he got to meet sort of all of the people behind the scenes. And so they said, hey, when we finally get a chance to put Skyfall together, you're our man.
Wow.
So we'll
I was watching Bond.
That.
I was wondering, like, do you go... Do you write the story first or do you find out what stuntsmen are available first or do you think about what city? Like, where does the process begin?
From
his
experience was that he sort of walked in and said, they said, this is what we want you to do.
Okay.
So they'd obviously
worked it out.
They went, well, you seem to be able to do it. But of course, he had to do all of it without a helmet because James Bond doesn't wear a helmet.
I noticed that. That was terrifying.
And padding and no pad. He said it was pretty freaky. Even for someone who's, you know, free falls off the top of buildings on a motorbike, he said it was freaky.
Right. Well, it is. Look, it's one of the better parts of the film.
Is it?
Yeah. It's kind of, anyway, we won't do another scope.
Let's not go back.
You've got seconds, Lindy. Do you any other tidbits you want to tempt us with?
No. That's it.
Okay, easy. Beautiful. Yeah. Lindy Burns is on your radio after 7 o'clock. Coming up after me is the PM program. They'll bring you up to date on everything that's been happening in Australia, around the world. A very big thank you this week to Erin, to Mary Jane, to Luke, and to John, who's off to different parts of the station. The weekend's coming up. Be good to yourself. I don't have one of those classic weekend sign-offs. All I will say is it's 6 o'clock, so it must be time for the news.